Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tonight, one of the most respected curators in contemporary art comes to the Philbrook Museum for a lecture on the ongoing exhibit devoted to the European furniture designers Ronan and Erwan Vorolek. Michael Darling has been an art historian, critic, and is currently the chief curator of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. Prior to joining the museum in 2010, Darling was the curator of modern contemporary art at the Seattle Art Museum, where he was honored for his innovative programming around underappreciated artists from around the globe. He's also been a curator at the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art as well. Darling has hosted exhibitions on the Vorolek brothers' designs in the past and will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at Philbrook on the Vorolek, From Pen to Product, which is free with museum admission. The exhibit, Ronan and Erwan Vorolek Album, continues to be on display at Philbrook through May 11th. Michael Darling joins us today by phone. Michael Darling, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In your work as a curator, you're looking at art constantly, but before that as an art historian and critic, you've always seen yourself in all of those roles, first as an art lover. I think you've said that at least one or two occasions. What in the Vorolek design, and specifically in their design process, appeals to you as an art lover?
Well, I think their work is very visual. You know, they have a really amazing sense of color, a very unique palette that they use in their work, and then each of their objects is really quite sculptural too. So they're very satisfying as objects just to look at in a room or in a store or something like that. But then, when you get to use them and sit on them or whatever the case might be, they're also very comfortable and very well designed, taking the body into account.
That is a sign of great design, the fact that it has that functional element, that it works. A couch is comfortable to sit on, a chair is comfortable to sit in, but it has to look beautiful too.
Exactly. And one thing I find is that a lot of contemporary designers today are trying to kind of make things look clever, fancy, eye-catching. And there's something about the Vorolek work that is still obviously very modern, very much suffused with a contemporary sensibility, and yet they're kind of rooted in something very historical and kind of recognizable. I mean, you look at one of their pieces, whether it's a table or a chair or a desk, and you know what the function of that is. They're not trying to, be so far out that just for fashion's sake. And I think it's that mix of something very, modern, which usually comes in the materials or in some of the engineering feats that they might do, are married to very ancient kinds of ideas about how we sit, how a table functions within a house, and those kinds of things. So I think that they're very mature and kind of grounded in a way that other flashier contemporary designers might not be.
And yet the final product looks utterly contemporary, but you're right. It's just a few little things here. And the one thing that I wish we had here in Tulsa was more of the objects themselves, so you could see if the design construction was like, space age elements, new polymers and that sort of thing. Or is it time and tested materials?
Well, I'd say that they do a bit of both. They are unusual in that they get really excited about the challenges of fabrication. And so they'll really go, if they're working with a manufacturer, really go to the factory plant, talk to the engineers, understand what the limitations are of, say, injected molded plastic, and really work with those engineers to figure out what the frontiers of that material are and how they can push beyond those or kind of create new innovation. So they really get invested in those kinds of procedures, and they'll use things that are incredibly modern like that. But lately they've also been very excited about working with much more traditional craftsmen. There's a small little firm in Italy, a woodworking firm, a family-owned business that I guess was getting, kind of close to the edge of kind of a financial crisis, and the Vorolek brothers came in with some designs that are very modern in look, but really use old-fashioned, handmade woodworking techniques and wood joinery to make these really beautiful chairs, and that's really revived the financial fortunes of this company. So I think they're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but are really trying to figure out what in old traditional techniques might still be applicable to ideas of today.
Now, when you say that, I'm thinking of something like the Oso chair.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that chair is really interesting because it's the essential elements of a chair. It's four pieces, but it's, if you can think of it, they're four pieces of just beautifully polished wood that sort of correspond with the left and right buttock and the left and right shoulder.
Right, exactly. And I guess, you know, those four pieces that are then kind of joined together with old-fashioned joinery are that size because that's the width of the plank of the wood, so they're not necessarily, you know, trying to make a single surface out of a piece of wood that doesn't exist in that width. So, they're really working within limitations of that particular wood mill and what the capabilities of the milling tools are that the factory there has. And so they really are coming up with all kinds of ways, yeah, to work within restraints and yet still come up with a design solution that works for everybody.
Now, one of the things about this particular exhibition album is the fact that you're seeing more of the design process than the actual design. And it's really, it goes back to drawing. And what's really amazing is, given the range of drawing in there, it's everything from doodlings that may end up in a design or something that's a design that's thought about but never conceived, as well as, you can see on a number of pieces, sort of some of the extrapolations you get to before you get to the final drawings that become a piece. They have a system of what they call vegetal chairs, which are what look to me like outdoor lawn furniture, but they have these wonderful sort of latticework designs in the chairs themselves, and at least the drawings that surround this, you can see sort of these different iterations. They actually thought of, on their website, they say that it sort of, they wanted a chair that came from the ground up that sort of reflected old styles, but it was, you know, contemporary, hence the name vegetal. And you can see these various iterations of this sort of interweaving vine-like lattice work and what worked and what didn't over the course of a design process.
Right. Yeah, and that's a good example of where the immediacy of their drawings and this very linear quality that they might have in their drawings, they were really able to translate that to a finished manufactured product. But it was not easy. I think that chair took several years of development, and that's one of the ones that I was mentioning in terms of injected molded plastics. I mean, they wanted to push hot molten plastic through a mold to fill out all of those different branches that form that chair, and when they started the process, it was technically impossible to do that. And so they really worked with these engineers to come up with molds and other techniques to push that molten material through these molds and create this. It's actually a three-part chair. I think the seat, back, and front legs are all one piece, and then the two back legs are attached separately. And that was, again, kind of the limitations of the machinery. But they were really able to preserve something that still feels very loose and fresh and natural, even though there's this incredible amount of engineering that's been brought to bear on it.
Well, one of the things you can see in the exhibit is how they'll play with pretty much an abstract design to begin with. Just I'm looking at a couple of finished objects here. One is a faucet, and then there's the Piani lamp, which has this very strong sort of upside down L structure.
Uh-huh.
And you can see in a whole series of drawings how they're thinking of it in three dimensions, they're thinking of it in two dimensions. And I think this is the interesting thing about the exhibit, and I think this is what they wanted to accomplish in this particular exhibit, is put all these drawings out there to sort of see the design process, but also see the drawing process of coming up with a design idea on their own merit.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, one thing that I'm sure that is described in the exhibition is how just constantly both of the brothers do draw. But the other thing is how very distinctive each of their drawing styles is. Ronan, the older brother, really was trained more in industrial design. And he has a very minimal, kind of methodical approach to his drawings, oftentimes in color, that are very kind of layered and everything. And then the younger brother, Erwan, was trained more in fine arts, painting and drawing and things like that, that had less of a practical grounding in it. And so his drawings are much more whimsical. His are the ones that do oftentimes look like cartoons and strange fantastical animals and things. And so the marrying of these two aesthetics both in their drawing, but then of course also in the finished design products, is really one of the fascinating aspects of their partnership, I think.
Well, I know it's really, there's a lot of challenges involved in presenting design in this country, because I think Americans have while we have a sense of appreciation for good design, probably as much as anywhere else, we often take it for granted. So whereas the Borlex are very well known in Europe, they're not really known in this country. And most designers, in fact, unless they become some sort of mass appeal designer, are not really well known in this country.
Yeah, it is true. And, we struggled with that a little bit with our show here in Chicago. Didn't think that their names would have much recognition amongst the general public. But it was really, the show's success really built on word of mouth, because people, were talking about how immersive and exciting this environment was that the brothers created with their work. And so we really felt like this was an opportunity for us to broadcast them as major designers that people here in the States ought to know more about.
Well, give us a sense of who Ronan and Erwan Borlak are.
Well, yeah, I've gotten to know them over probably about 10 years now, and they're both very quiet, very thoughtful. They're about 5 years apart, but yet, and of course, they grew up in the countryside of France in a very close-knit family, and so there's this camaraderie and kind of understanding that they have of each other, but also a rivalry, too. I mean, they bicker and fight quite a bit with each other, especially as they're trying to arrive at a solution to a particular design. But the thing that I've really admired also about their the way that they've developed their business and their practice over the years is that they really want to retain control of everything that they do. So they have turned down big, flashy offers to design hotels in Miami and things like that, because they really want to see every single design through to completion and really bring a level of thought and care to each one of these designs. So they turn down many more invitations than they accept. They've kept their design studio quite small, and it's really become a wonderful training ground for young designers that have come through there to work with them, to learn their ideas and techniques, and then in many cases these designers have then gone on to do good work on their own as well. So they've been very careful to maintain a certain level of integrity to their work, which I think maybe has prevented them from becoming big household names that are making kind of products that are distributed all over the world. But at the same time, within the design community, I mean, they still are very much rock stars. I mean, they're some of the most well-respected designers. They work with the best furniture design companies around the world, and they do museum shows around the world too, which you can't say the same for a lot of contemporary designers. And I think it's that level of quality and attention to detail that translates across the design world into the fine art and the museum world.
But when you look at their industrialized product, I know there are certain European manufacturers, but a lot of them don't import to the United States. I know Herman Miller's got maybe a couple of pieces. Not a lot of their designs really have been sort of industrialized, if you will. I mean, a lot of times they're specific commissions.
Yeah, that's true, and they do work on a wide range, and they take advantage of the different capabilities of each of these manufacturers in different ways. So they do very limited edition, expensive pieces for a gallery in Paris called Galerie Créau, that often becomes a testing ground for ideas and materials that then they could adapt to bigger, more commercial applications. And so that's something that you'll see a lot in their work, kind of moving from a really rarefied, handcrafted kind of object to then translating that same thing to mass production using plastics and stamped metals and other things like that might scale up a bit more. But, a couple of the companies they work for, like Cartel, has showrooms in many big cities across the U.S. And also, their products are shown in more progressive design shops. Vitra also has design shops, I know, in New York and Los Angeles. I don't know if they even have one here in Chicago. And then, as you mentioned, Herman Miller is starting to carry some products from some of these other companies. So little by little, you're finding them around. Alessi also, the Italian design company that has stores in different American cities, that they've done china and silverware for them too. So you have to look a little bit, but the stuff is out there and available for sale.
My guest today is Michael Darling, the chief curator of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, who will be speaking tonight at 6:30 on the Borelex from Pin to Product as a part of the exhibit at Philbrook Museum, Ronan and Erwan Borelek album, which is on display through May 11th at the museum, which shows not necessarily the design, finished design pieces, although there are a few pieces in the show. It's mainly the design process. And I have to say, one problem I think about this exhibit is it presumes quite a bit of knowledge by the visitors. And really looking at their work online on their website is, I think, sort of a must before seeing the show to really get the most out of it, because you begin to see the range of their design work, because it's everything from, for example, there are some of their newest work, their 3D knitted fabrics, which I guess they're just coming out with this year. You see some swatches in the show, along with some really amazing things from these amazing room dividers, which because of this sort of egalitarian nature of the show, there's no commentary on what you're seeing, but it's some of the most amazing just visual elements. These room dividers known as clouds, which I guess you had in your show in Chicago.
Yes, we did.
What's most impressive about those particular pieces?
Well, they are incredibly tactile. You just feel good when you're next to these objects. They're made out of what almost appears to be kind of felt that's been sandwiched over a thin layer of foam. So they have a kind of a warmth and a softness and a thickness to them. But they're also incredibly variegated, so they have all these kind of cuts in them that allow them to be folded in different ways, and you're supposed to attach these different pieces to one another to then create, you can create walls with them, you can create kind of bulbous kind of sculptural forms that you could hang on the wall as a sculpture. And the thing that's interesting about those, I think, is it's part of a whole category of work that the brothers have done over the years where they've invented systems and products for market niches that didn't exist before. So who knew that we needed to have do-it-yourself screen dividers or room dividers? But they've kind of come up with several different products in that range that now have started to really take on. There's another one called Algue that they did, which is the French word for algae or seaweed. And
yes.
These are little plastic branches that you can just start snapping together, and pretty soon you have a big curtain of these, and you can really use them to divide space or hang them in your windows as almost like a lace curtain kind of thing. And, this is something that they just designed out of thin air. There was no precedent for it, really. And so that's something that they do that I think is also really exciting, and these clouds that you mentioned are a good example of that.
Well, it's really interesting because, we have screens. You know, there's a long history of screens, but that's been out of style for, 70, 80, 90 years,
Right.
And now all of a sudden they're bringing this back in its own way, in a very contemporary way.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, it's really some amazing work. One of the things that was really interesting about your exhibit, as you mentioned, was that you wanted visitors to actually experience the design work by, sitting on a plume sofa, which is this giant, it looks like almost like a giant sponge, but it's apparently an incredibly comfortable sofa. What's that experience like actually interacting with their work?
Well, it's an interesting question because, I work in a contemporary art museum, and oftentimes the work that we show can be quite challenging, and you kind of get used to people having slightly perplexed looks on their faces when they're walking through the galleries. But I really sensed in people's body language in this exhibition a certain relaxation. People, like I mentioned before, they saw the object, recognized it as a chair or a table, and immediately had a connection to it in a way that was very different from a piece of sculpture or a contemporary painting or something. So there's a familiarity and an immediacy to their work that puts you at ease, and you know, you inst- instinctively know how to use that object. And then once they, you know, start to sit in these pieces, especially if they're made from some high-tech material, whether it's plastic or these 3D printed textiles that you mentioned, you know, they're surprised by the comfort and the kind of fineness of the detailing. And so that's really, that was really exciting to sort of see people trying things out and recognizing that, you know, not only did they look really good, but they also were incredibly functional.
My guest today is Michael Darling, a chief curator of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, who will be speaking tonight at 6:30 on the Borelux from Pin to Product as a part of the exhibition Ronan and Erwan Borelux Album, which is on display at Philbrook Museum through May 11th. This is the second exhibit in the partnership between the Vitra Design and Philbrook, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things, looking at what you've been doing in recent years, you know, you went from Los Angeles to Seattle, now to Chicago. So one of the things you do as a curator, and maybe this comes from the, your background as a historian critic, is you really try to immerse yourself into your community. Can you maybe talk about the last 4 years here in Chicago and how you've been, I know you've been doing a series of commentary on architecture. Of course, Chicago has this incredible collection of architecture that sort of spans the 20th century. What's been the most interesting thing about learning about Chicago's art?
Well, we're really lucky here in Chicago that we've got a pretty rich ecosystem, as I like to call it, here in Chicago, in terms of having, you know, a great group of museums here. We have great private collectors who are avidly collect contemporary art especially. We also have a number of art schools here, which are often really key to the ecosystem, because not only do you have, you know, students coming into the city to study art and practice art, but you have more senior artists that are serving as teachers that are, can then, you know, make a living, hopefully, in the city making their art and teaching. And so it really creates a critical mass of interested parties in art. And so I've been really, you know, excited about that community that we have here in Chicago. And making sure that not only we're bringing in things from outside of Chicago that we think might be relevant to that audience, but also making sure to always have Chicago artists on view at the museum. So we've been doing a project here called that we call Chicago Works, where about every three or four times a year we change over a solo exhibition with a Chicago artist that comes along with a nice brochure that has new writing on that artist's work. And we, you know, half, about at least half, if not more than half of our audience are tourists, so we feel like this is a great way for us to give visitors a sense of what's happening creatively in Chicago at all times. And then we also are very committed to mixing Chicago artists into other exhibitions that we have, whether they're group shows or other types of solo shows. So we really have taken that on as a mandate here to have Chicago artists in our programming at all times.
How important is that for the community? Because I think the temptation for a large institution is to say, well, there are plenty of other outlets where you can see local art. Our job is to bring in national, international art of what else is happening elsewhere to Chicago or to a city. How important is it to actually integrate what's happening in your own hometown with the things you bring in?
I mean, I think it's really important because, you know, something that I've noticed as, you know, traveling around the country is oftentimes in some of these museums in big cities, they start to look the same. You know, they're collecting the same blue chip artists and displaying them in the same way. And so I really want people to come here and know that they're somewhere else, that they're in Chicago, that they're seeing art that's inflected by Chicago. And having local Chicago artists in the mix of other things that they're seeing really assures that happens. And I think it's also just something that, you know, we do provide a pretty visible platform. And so to delegate this task of showing and exhibiting a Chicago artist to some other, you know, venue in town, I think sort of shirks that responsibility of using this platform to promote our artists out to the world and hopefully help them develop their careers, you know, beyond Chicago as well, which I think is really key to keeping them here. If they can make careers here that are nurtured allow them to exhibit and become well known around the country or even around the world, then I think we're really doing our job to help that.
Obviously, as a contemporary curator, you always have to be seeing new things all the time. I was really struck by something you wrote not too long ago. You said, we should view artists as comparable to advanced researchers in the sciences, like medicine or physics. It says that artists basically had that same professionalizing effect because most of your artists now have MFAs, they have advanced degrees. And I was wondering, you know, we think of the self-taught artist, is that overall a better development?
You know, I think it is a double-edged sword, because I think with, you know, this analogy that I use sometimes of this researcher or kind of, you know, comparing artists to mathematicians or scientists, you know, I do think that artists need to know the field that they're working in, understand what's been done and where areas of growth and exploration could be. Sometimes, you know, things become a little too predictable of when it's that professionalized, and rules are maybe followed a little too closely. So there are always going to be those kind of free radicals in the system. You know, the self-taught artists, the artists that have kind of developed outside of a school system that can shake things up. But I think that those are much rarer occurrences, and you know, I definitely like to make myself open to those kind of artists when they come around. But I do feel that the artists that are taking things really seriously in their studio every day, you know, just absolutely committed to this because this is what their life work is all about, are the ones that really are making the most significant contributions, and those are the ones that we tend to really pay attention to, I think, here at the museum level.
And of course, that's what we should value too. The value should be the same. I mean, it's the same level of training and competence going into what they do.
Yeah, and I think it's that analogy helps to justify this newness. So it's not that we're just jaded, looking for the next new thing, you know, and it's some kind of superficial gloss that's being put on something. I really do feel that this newness that we look for is something that we've never seen before, and therefore it's exciting, and therefore it's expanding our ideas about what art can be, and so I think that's where this newness and innovation start to really matter and really mean something.
Of course, that superficial gloss does remain, and it's, I guess, the curator's job to be able to tell the difference.
Exactly. No, and there's, you know, especially with the art market being as overheated as it is these days, I mean, there's, you know, emperors without clothes that are being minted every day, and so I really think it is our job to go out there and look at this work carefully. You know, a lot of times it really takes going to meet the artist in their studio to see if they're for real or not, and so that's something that we take very seriously, I think, too.
All right. Well, we look forward to your appearance in Tulsa to discuss the Borlick exhibit at Philbrook. Michael Darling, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Darling is the chief curator of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago and will be speaking tonight at Philbrook Museum of Art at 6:30 on the Borlex from Pin to Product, which will accompany the current exhibit at the museum, Ronan and Erwan Borlek album, which will be on display at the museum through May 11th. For more details, visit philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, you can visit our website, publicradiotulsa.org, and look through our archives or just search for recent Studio Tulsa programs. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you for listening.